720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Nice to be with you today. Thank you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. As ever, I'm grateful to you for that. And you know what? This time last week, we were sitting here looking at the beautiful weather. We were admiring it, and people were walking by in like tank tops because it was warm and beautiful, and people are walking by all bundled up. This is the world we live in, my friends. But nonetheless, lots to do today on the Wintrust Business Lunch. A little bit later, we're going to be talking about Uber because Uber cannot seem to stay out of the news lately. So we're going to be talking with Amina Alahi from Blue Sky Innovation upstairs at the Tribune. We're going to be talking with her, and we're going to talk with an architect about the idea of infrastructure that we already have and how it may or may not need some updating to accept the idea of driverless cars. Turns out we have to rethink kind of a lot of stuff. So we're going to be talking about that. But before we get to all that, our good friend Mark Horner is on the phone. He is the president of Fairhaven Wealth Management, a certified financial planner and a wealth advisor. Mark, hello. Good to be with you again. Thanks for joining us. Uh-oh. Where's Mark? You with us, Mark?
Amy?
There you are. Hi.
Sorry about that. Good to be with you.
Great to have you back on. Always appreciate you coming on to share your knowledge with us. So tell us about America Saves Week, because that is the thing that's happening starting next week. And apparently we're not saving enough money. Could it be because we're not making enough? Could it be about that?
That could be one of the reasons. America Saves Week, though, real briefly, is an annual initiative to try and bring focus to primarily the idea for people, the importance of people saving for retirement, but it also goes a bit broader to include trying to promote educational awareness about other personal financial topics, so the appropriate use of debt and just the importance of financial planning. So it's a wonderful initiative because the savings rate across the country is quite low and has been consistently low. So to try and do something to improve that, I think again is a fantastic focus this coming week.
Well, what I really love about the information that you bring for us, Mark, is that there's always this underlying message of education and helping people to understand what's going on so we can make choices wisely in our financial lives, which I really think is so great. But you sent along some information about savings in this country that are surprising. I would have perhaps given us a bit more, overestimated this a bit, but in fact, it is, as you say, a bit lower. I was particularly surprised that there is a bit of a savings gap between men and women. How do you explain that?
Well, so a recent study, and some of these studies, you got to be a little careful looking at information just in silos. But the study that you're referencing revealed that a greater percentage of men across the country tend to feel that they are on track for their savings goals than women. And I've seen other studies that maybe flip-flops that information. So I think what's underneath that more recent study that we're talking about, I think there's also overwhelming evidence that men tend to be far more overconfident in their abilities just in general than women. So that's true when men estimate their financial preparedness. That's also true when men estimate their ability as just drivers, so in just in everyday activity. So I think that there might be a little bit more to that information than just men are doing a better job saving than women. So I'd be mm-hmm. a little slow to jump to that conclusion just from that data.
Well, it sounds like the key thing you said there was that when you were talking about men feel they're more on track with their savings goals than women. So there could also be a degree of what you've set your goal to be and how you feel you are meeting it involved there too. I think, as you say, there are nuances there indeed. What are the main educational points that people really need to focus on with America Saves Week to help get themselves on the right track and make the most of the week and learn from it and take advantage of all the educational resources available to them?
Yeah, so I completely agree with you that the first step in addressing, I'd say, any issue where we're falling short of our goals, so including personal finances, is education and awareness. I think people need to first understand a little bit about the problem or the goal that they're trying to accomplish before, in order to take appropriate steps towards achieving that goal. I think a focus for the week is a fabulous thing to do, but I think it really needs to go further than that. And I don't know that education on basic financial concepts can start early enough. So I'd love to see America Saves Week morph into a regular part of the curriculum in even grades as low as kindergarten. Because I know my wife and I've got four kids, and they range in age from fourth grader up to a senior in high school. And we've talked to them about, it is my business, so I bring work home and, sure, and talk a little bit about financial planning with them. And a number of years ago, we made a deal with them that when they got money for birthdays or babysitting money, that whatever money they decided to put into their personal savings accounts, their mother and I would match that dollar for dollar. So in a similar functioning way that company 401k plans work, and it's been amazing to eavesdrop on some of the conversations that the kids have had when mom and dad are out of the room, where they talk to each other about, you know, how much money are you going to put in your savings account? Because, you know, I've got my eye on this video game, and I'm thinking maybe I'll save half of it and spend the rest on a video game, because I don't want to miss out on that free money from mom and dad. And these are, you know, again, these are fourth graders having these kinds of conversations. So the kids absolutely get these concepts. But again, they need to be presented to them, and so this is not the importance of saving and the power of time and compound interest. Those aren't concepts that we're all just naturally born understanding. They need to be learned, and they need to be taught. So again, I think it'd be wonderful to see this curriculum in schools. I'd say for everybody listening today, don't wait. You know, don't wait for the government to act. Start talking about personal finances with your kids today. And it doesn't need to be anything more complicated than hey, if you set up a savings account, mom and dad or your aunt or uncle or grandma and grandpa, whoever, will match 50 cents on the dollar, or we'll match dollar for dollar. And the kids will understand that. And I think the more that we do that, the more, the better chance that we have for future generations to put a dent in the savings issue that we've got right now in the country.
Well, that's so interesting how you're modeling that financial literacy for your children. We're talking all about America Saves Week. You can find out about it, americasavesweek.org. There's a lot of information there. We're talking with Mark Horner, who is president of Fairhaven Wealth Management. He is a certified financial planner and a wealth advisor. We're going to take a little break, and when we come back, Mark, I'd love to talk with you more about Million Dollar Cup of Coffee, a project that you're working on.
That'd be great.
Okay, we'll be right back in just a bit on 720 WGN. WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. A little bit later in the program, we're going to be talking with Amina Alahi from Blue Sky Innovation upstairs at the Tribune, all about Uber, since it can't seem to stay out of the headlines these days. But right now, we're talking with Mark Horner. You may remember we had him on around the time we moved into 2017, talking about financial resolutions to make. And he is back with us today talking about our savings, because a lot of data is showing we are just not saving enough for retirement. And he, as president of Fairhaven Wealth Management and as a certified financial planner and wealth advisor, is here to help talk with us about that and help us think it through in really doable kind of ways, which we always appreciate from you, Mark. You're very buzzword-free kind of doable, pro pro-education way of doing things. And before the break, we were talking about America Saves Week and how you believe that financial literacy really cannot start soon enough in a child's life, which is really interesting. I loved hearing the story about how the deal you have made with your children to kind of match their savings, which is very cool, and it's a really interesting idea. Tell us a little bit, if you would, about Million Dollar Cup of Coffee, another project that you're working on.
Yeah, absolutely. So about 3 years ago, I've been in, this is my 17th year in the financial planning business, and just over the years, clients have periodically asked, "Hey, can our kids come in and work in the office as interns?" Which we always love to have. And about 3 years ago, I just decided to use one of couple of our interns for the summer to put together a survey that was designed to go out for young people to, number one, gauge their interest in personal finance topics, and then if they were interested, how best would they like to receive the information and how would they not like to receive the information. So it was a brief survey, 20 questions. It was distributed to about 100 people. We sent it out to clients and friends of the firm and asked them to pass it along to younger people that we defined as just kind of high school or college age. And we had over 450 people complete the survey, which I was shocked at the number that participated, and the feedback was just overwhelming. That number one, younger people were absolutely interested in learning more about personal financial topics, and secondly, that they were very clear about what they wanted and what they didn't want. So they wanted on-demand information, short and concise, to the point, jargon free. We got a lot of feedback that said the investment world can be a little intimidating with its terminology and therefore hard to access the information. But no webinars, no books, no hour long classrooms. And they also responded very well to the what we titled the survey. So we called the survey the Million Dollar Cup of Coffee, and what we said was, if we could show you how to become a millionaire by the time you retire by saving the equivalent of a cup of coffee when you start at age 20, would you be interested? And that's just illustrating the financial concept of compound interest, which is just when you make an investment. And then you make interest on the interest that your investment produces. That has enormous power if done over longer periods of time. So we took that feedback and ran with it. And about a year ago, we launched the Million Dollar Cup of Coffee. And what that is a video-based educational and literacy campaign where we produce monthly videos addressing a range of topics, not just investing, but a range of personal financial topics, and we're having just wonderful feedback from it.
I bet. Well, I think the key that I'm really hearing from you is what you said about jargon. I think because we don't tend to start financial education until adulthood, everything can, it seems very intimidating. And then you're confronted with a lot of jargon around the financial industry. And then it's even more intimidating. So I think it's kind of this double, you know, this kind of two-pronged issue, right? That both it all seems in code, and we don't start talking about it until we're kind of out of the nest on our own. And so I think that's really, really key. So in the time that we have left, and we do have to unfortunately say goodbye here in a moment, but as we move into America Saves Week, which people can read about at americasavesweek.org, what's kind of the top one or two tips in your mind for how people can start saving, if not more, maybe in a better way, in a more effective way?
Yeah, so I'd say three things that people should focus on. Number one, education, which we've talked about I think a lot this morning. So getting access to education where it's delivered to you in an understandable way. Secondly, is putting your financial goals down in writing. Data again is overwhelming that written goals have a far greater probability of being achieved than the non-written goals. And then thirdly, automate your savings as much as you possibly can. So whether that's at the company 401k plan, where you can just automate your monthly contributions. Some plans even offer the ability to automatically escalate your contributions each year. So when you get raises, you're putting more and more money into your 401k plan. If you don't have access to a 401k plan, setting up an IRA, so that's an individual retirement account, or a Roth IRA, and again, automating that process as much as you can, because, you know, life gets busy with, and so let's take one thing off the plate and just automate your retirement savings.
That is the truth. Life gets busy. Well, I appreciate, as ever, I appreciate you joining us and breaking it down in easy to digest ways. Mark Horner, president of Fairhaven Wealth Management, certified financial planner and wealth advisor. Thanks so much for being with us again today.
Great being with you, Amy.
All right. Have a great Saturday. All right, friends, we're going to take a little break and then get you to news and all that good stuff back in just a bit on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. And thank you for sharing part of your Saturday with me. I'm always grateful to you for that. Still lots to do on the show today. We, a little bit later, are going to be talking about driverless cars, in particular, how that would work in Chicago and whether or not we have the infrastructure in place already to take on this idea of cars with no drivers. So we'll be talking about that. But right now we're joined by Amina Alahi from Blue Sky Innovation upstairs at the Tribune. Hello. How are you? Thanks for being with us today.
Hi, I'm great. Thanks for having me.
Well, we always appreciate having you on. So, you know, it seems like Uber cannot stay out of the headlines right now. It has been an interesting week for Uber. I would say it has been interesting for Uber since this administration took office, really, because right after the executive order travel ban was signed, we saw a large scale boycott happening. A lot of people using the hashtag delete Uber. But then this week, we saw this this former Uber employee wrote a blog post that was just scathing about her experience working there. And it really created a lot of ripples across the tech industry with a lot of the tech giants in their internal culture, not just at Uber. And a lot of conversation has been happening around that. But right now, it seems like Uber is suddenly going, wait, hold up. Don't abandon us. We need you. Hold on. And it seems like they're in a tough spot.
They are. And, you know, Uber is one of those companies that's often in the headlines, both because they're disruptive and innovative and also because they tend to attract controversy, shall we say. So it does seem like this year has been kind of a rocky one for them in terms of PR, at least.
Indeed. And so what is their current strategy? I mean, it seems like they did kind of issue a statement just saying, like, hold up, don't delete it so fast. But Are they trying to make amends? Are they trying to do anything to get people back? Or are they just simply asking them to reconsider their position?
Well, to be specific, the issue at hand this week is that this woman who wrote the blog post wrote about systemic sexism and particularly sexual harassment issues at the company that she felt were essentially ignored, even though she says she reported them several times and that her other female coworkers also did the same. So what the company is now doing is trying to conduct an investigation, which they say is going to be independent. They hired Eric Holder, former U.S. Attorney General, to lead the investigation. So there's the outside source, but they're also using sort of people from within. Their head of HR and Arianna Huffington, who is a board member, are also going to be participating in this investigation. And they're essentially trying to figure out sort of what is wrong with the culture here? What needs to be fixed? Who needs to be fired, if anyone? Is this really a systemic issue? So it seems like they're trying to very quickly and publicly address the situation, which is important for a company that has in the past already been accused of sort of sexist attitudes from the CEO and from employees. So it'll be interesting to see whether this move of, you know, taking on the investigation is actually going to sort of quell the dissent from users and drivers alike.
Certainly. Well, I think anecdotally we've seen and heard of a lot of drivers switching from Uber to Lyft. But in the piece that you wrote, everybody head to chicagotribune.com/bluesky and you can find this piece. But in the piece that you wrote, you talked to a driver who had moved from Uber to Lyft. And are you getting the sense that that is a widespread move, or is that purely anecdotal?
Well, it's a little complicated, first of all, because these drivers are independent contractors, and they can drive for as few or as many of these services as they want. So many of them drive for Uber, but they also drive for its competitor, Lyft, and they just sort of sign on to each of those services when they're available, and they switch off. This driver in particular, who I spoke to, decided to move away from Uber earlier this year, in part in response to those protests that you were mentioning at the top of this conversation, related to servicing JFK during a traffic strike, or rather a taxi strike during the airport protests. That didn't sit well with him, but you know, Uber has been criticized for treatment of its drivers in general, as have many other sort of gig economy type companies with their independent contractors. So if drivers are moving away, I imagine it's not only because of this issue. It's more likely sort of, you know, the perfect storm of all of these different different concerns coming together at once.
Truly. Well, you write so much about this topic and the issues around it. Do you get the sense that this blog post written by this former Uber employee about how she felt that her HR claims were mishandled and or straight ignored in some moments, do you feel like it's been a lot of talk this week around it, but do you feel like it's going to create the ripples that the tech industry needs in order to reform its culture, or do you think more is still needed?
Well, I think what this blog post did is sort of capture the worst fears of everyone who is a proponent of gender equality and against sexual harassment in the tech industry, which are both issues that seem to be widespread. And as you know, there have been many instances of, you know, on the record and sort of off the record reports of these types of things. And since it's been talked about so much in the past, it sort of makes you wonder whether one incident, even as high profile as this, can really reform an industry. That said, it could help move things in the right direction in terms of other companies speaking to their own employees or looking at their own policies and seeing where they might have weaknesses in terms of addressing these types of issues, or even realizing that, you know, it can be a really big PR problem. And like, maybe they don't want to be made an example of this way. So people may become more proactive, and perhaps you will see a change in sort of who's in control as well, like whether investors react to these types of issues will probably be a huge in how they change in the future.
Right. It usually does come down to change won't often happen in a culture unless it does impact the bottom line. Rarely do we see it just happens because it's the right thing to do. Although we do see more of that, I think, in the last few years in the tech sector than we have before. But it'll be interesting to see how this plays out for Uber for sure. Well, thank you so much for being with us today. Again, everybody head to chicagotribune.com/bluesky and you can read this story and more by Amina Alahi. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you. I enjoyed it.
All right. So we are going to take a little break. And when we come back, we are going to imagine Chicago overrun with driverless cars. What would that look like? And what would we need to make that happen? And should we let that and make that and want that in the first place? I don't know. We're going to figure it out when we come back here on the Wintrust Business Lunch on 720 WGN. Hey, it's Amy Guth here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Thanks for being with us today. Hope you're keeping warm. I know last week I said I hope you're outside enjoying the sunshine. So that is the opposite of what I meant last week. The weather changes a lot here in Chicago. That's always been the way, but lately especially, it's been a weird one. I thought we were free and we were on to summer. In fact, I think I've even seen lots of little flower bulbs, little shoots coming up out of the ground. Poor little things. I hope they're not freezing today, but indeed, we will always keep you updated on that weather, of course. So still plenty to do here on the Wintrust Business Lunch. Let us imagine for a minute driverless cars and what the city might look like if we were to have a bunch of them, right? It seems very sci-fi. It seems like a thing in the way, way future. But in fact, it is not, right? We all know driverless cars are a thing and they're coming. But what kind of infrastructure is involved in that? And what kind of policy do we need to make that work in the right and safe and smart way? Well, there's a lot to consider there. Blair Kamen wrote about that recently in the Chicago Tribune, all about how driverless cars could change the urban landscape. And to talk about that with us today, we're joined by Marshall Brown, who is an architect and architecture professor at Illinois Institute of Technology. Hi, Marshall. Thanks so much for being with us today.
Hi. Good afternoon.
Well, thanks for joining us today. So as we imagine and think towards moving into a place where we are experimenting with driverless cars, which is definitely a thing, even though they're not, you know, in widespread use yet. And there are a lot of infrastructure issues come up quickly there. And that's attached to a project that you've been working on called the Driverless City. Tell us a bit about that, if you would.
Sure. Last year at IIT, myself and my project partners, from across the university, actually conducted a research project that asked the question, you know, how we can transform our urban environment, specifically our transportation infrastructure, into, let's say, more humane infrastructure for the 21st century by leveraging driverless technology.
And where did you land with that? As you stepped off into the project with that hypothesis, where did it take you?
Well, we landed in a lot of places. You know, we looked at multiple scales of issues. So from the scale of the street to the scale of parking to the scale of, you know, things like regional delivery to the scale of the commute. So one of the challenges with thinking about this this opportunity is that it affects a huge number of things in our lives, potentially, from how we get to school and to work, to how we get groceries, to how, you know, goods and services get delivered around the region and the country, to how we work. So in that sense, in many ways, it opens up more questions than answers, but we were able to develop some scenarios about what kinds of places we might see, even if we can't put our finger right now on absolutely what the kind of, you know, let's say, for example, street or parking lot of the future might look like. I think we were able to touch on a lot of the different kinds of issues that are already on the table. So, for example, you know, what happens when cars can either park themselves and or can park much more closely together? We currently now have a huge amount of our urban landscape dedicated to surface parking, for example. And so what happens, how are we going to use this land differently in the future when we don't need it for that purpose anymore?
Sure. Yeah, it does bring up a lot of interesting questions. You also, in the project, you talk a bit about designing guidelines for transportation agencies. How does that factor in?
Sure. Well, we're not quite there yet. One of my project partners was Jack Guthman, who is a planning lawyer based here in Chicago. And, you know, it really starts with a review of what the existing laws are on the books with regard to the technology. And currently there really aren't any. And so we have to go step by step in terms of, you know, first of all, as citizens, I think we have to challenge our policymakers and our legislators to kind of get on the ball with this. But so far, that's been difficult because there's so much uncertainty still around the technology. And so this is one of the big problems that we talked about in our research, or dealt with in our research, is just the kind of cultural lag. Mm-hmm. So right now, the technology is moving forward very quickly, but policy has not, you know, policy and laws and potential, you know, new, let's say, codes around development, et cetera, haven't caught up. And they're a long way from catching up, I think.
Yeah. I mean, I think that's a topic we talk about a lot on this show as we find places where technology and law are just not equally, not on the same page, that one hasn't caught up with the other, which I think is really interesting. It's usually because technology is moving much faster than the law does. So what surprised you the most as you stepped into this project? Was there an unexpected, maybe a benefit attached to it you didn't see coming, or maybe an unexpected downside or something like that?
Everything is sort of, we built the project around the idea of uncertainty. So it's hard to talk about things which are unexpected, because we went into the project, expecting the unexpected, let's say. That being said, one of the things I can say for myself personally, but seems obvious now, is that, driverless cars are robots. Right? Driverless cars are robots. This is something that we learned from some of our colleagues at IIT who are actually in the robotics program, who are looking at it from that point of view. And so once you start to think of the driverless, the car no longer as a car, as a machine, but as, let's say, a particular kind of machine, a robot, a kind of sentient machine, then that sort of brings all kinds of other questions into play. And so there starts to be this, in the discussion about robotics, people talk a lot about the co-evolution of, humans and machines. So how we begin to change the way we are in relationship to these machines. And so that, I think, is a really rich part of the discussion to think about, that gets into the matters of philosophy, biology, politics, culture, et cetera, et cetera. So it's not just about, being able to send the thing to pick up your groceries, but it's really about kind of how are we going to live with these machines, and how are we going to live also differently with them? And so, that opens up, a whole set of very interesting conversations, which go beyond, let's say, the technical questions. One of the questions we tried to avoid was this question which gets repeated often: how will driverless cars change our cities? We actually think that's the wrong question. The way we'd like to ask the question is, how will we change our cities, right, by leveraging technology in light of this technology? And it seems like a subtle difference, but it's a really important difference in terms of how we think about it, because the car will not do anything on its own. The driverless car will not do anything on its own. It's really about us and what our kind of collective and individual desires are about how we want our future to be.
It is a key, it's a subtle semantic shift, but it's a key one, I think. So what cities are leading with this, and where can we look that perhaps in your research you found maybe other groups in other cities that were thinking in the same way or approaching it similarly or maybe ahead of what we're doing here?
Well, Pittsburgh has been in the news a lot. That's the home of Carnegie Mellon, where a lot of research is being done. But, of course, Uber has also been doing a lot of work and testing in Pittsburgh. And then, of course, Silicon Valley in general is way ahead of the game, because that's where a lot of this technology is being developed. And then there are, test sites in places like Ann Arbor, Michigan, at the University of Michigan, where they have a test track called M-City. There's a new, larger test track being planned on the outskirts of Detroit in a former automotive and bomber manufacturing plant. So there are certain, there are several places around the country that have, let's say, gotten out of front. I think Pittsburgh is the one I know about, but especially in terms of, thinking about regulation and laws and actually enabling the use of the technology by the public. Pittsburgh and the state of Pennsylvania really, I think, they've gotten out in front of many or most states.
Very, very interesting. Was there anything that you found that would be a unique challenge to Chicago in particular when we think about this topic?
Oh, that's a very good one. I think, Chicago is a big city. It's vast. It's over 200 square miles in area, which is extremely large. And when we have, and I don't know if this is a problem or an opportunity, but it's an issue. When we have an advancement in transportation technology, it changes the relationship between time and space. So places that were farther apart suddenly now become closer together. So what we can reasonably expect, and a lot of people don't like to hear this, we could see, we can reasonably expect some urban expansion. So what people like to call sprawl. It's not my favorite term because it seems very negative, but we can reasonably expect that we'll see increasing urban expansion if this technology is broadly adopted. It remains to be seen whether there will be less or more traffic congestion. For sure, it will bring up challenges in terms of updating our infrastructure. And for a large city, just maintaining the infrastructure we have now is an ongoing challenge, and these challenges may increase even more. So it may put even more pressure on figuring out how to, you know, pay for infrastructure upgrades,
sure,
and maintenance and things like that, et cetera. And then, of course, there are the challenges to public transportation. You know, there's already discussion about how, you know, ride sharing and ride hailing might be cutting into ridership on buses and trains. So
yeah,
what we're looking at is a kind of broad reconfiguration of,
yeah,
you know, our transportation options, transit systems, et cetera, et cetera. So for a big city, those are all going to be real, really substantial challenges.
Yeah, there's so much to think about. This is such an interesting topic. So thank you so much for being with us today. Marshall Brown, architect and architecture professor at Illinois Institute of Technology. We'll hope to talk to you soon. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
All right, we're going to take a little break, get you to news and all that good stuff. Back in just a bit on 720 WGN.